Do you love Uncover from CBC Podcasts? What's your favorite season? Which one did you skip? What do you want to hear more of? Help us make Uncover even better by taking our listener survey now. Visit cbc.ca/uncoversurvey to make sure your voice is heard. This is a CBC podcast.
The following episode contains difficult subject matter. Please take care while listening. I'm Kathleen Goldhar. This is Crime Story. Every week, a new crime with the storyteller who knows it best.
I have two children. I didn't go through IVF, but I really wanted children. And I could imagine myself into that position of being like, well, this is the way that's available to me. I really want this. I'll go through it. So I think there are a million lessons one could take away from the podcast, but I think it's essential to look at ways to make fertility treatment kinder and gentler and more humane, you know, whatever that involves.
I have a very specific reaction to pain. It makes me incredibly angry. But if I'm in public and I hurt myself, I hate the attention. I just want to run away and cry. And I've never really thought about where that reaction might come from and whether it might be a learned behavior. That somewhere deep in my subconscious, I figured out that as a woman, I should keep my pain to myself. But when I sat down to listen to Susan Burton's podcast, The Retrievals, the idea of women's pain and how society reacts to it made me consider my own response to pain more closely. The Retrievals tells the story of patients of Yale University's fertility clinic. Dozens of women reported feeling excruciating pain during their egg retrievals. Women who had been trying to get pregnant for years. So they told themselves that the ends justified the means. They all wanted a baby. But there was something terrible happening at the clinic. Something that would have stopped earlier if the women's pain had been taken more seriously. Susan Burton is a veteran producer for This American Life and host of The Retrievals, and she joins me now. So tell me what drew you to the story. What sort of lit the fuse for you?
So I came across a local news article about this one night in November 2021. I was just immediately drawn to it. There were just the multiple layers like suggested by the few facts in the article I came across. I was drawn to, you know, addiction, to women's pain, to the longing to be a mother, to, you know, the real and symbolic power of Yale. And I just really wanted to know, like, who was this nurse and who were these patients and what happened?
So who were the patients and what did you find out was happening?
Sure. So once I started interviewing them and hearing their stories, you know, I was struck by the echoes in what they were telling me. A number of patients saying things like they'd told their doctors, as you said in the intro, you know, during the procedure, I feel everything. Others who'd had a different anesthetic protocol felt pain after the procedure and had, you know, asked their caregivers things like, I'm in so much pain. Is this normal? But then there was another echo I was noticing, too, and that had to do with the story that the women told themselves about the pain. And that story was often some version of, like, this pain is my fault. They blamed themselves for the pain. They thought, for example, that they just weren't sensitive to fentanyl, or that this was, you know, like conceiving a child. This was just another thing their body couldn't do, or that this was just what women go through.
Yeah, I was really struck by how it was like, well, maybe it does hurt this much. But I mean, there was one woman who told you that she felt every single retrieval, like every time they pulled an egg, she felt it and she could see what was happening. And I'm amazed that when she told the doctors and the nurses that, that they didn't react more strongly because that, I mean, as we know now, something was happening, but I mean, they know that isn't supposed to be the case. So it really was excruciating to listen to and very heartbreaking. But also, like I said in the intro, something that I think as a woman, you sort of also very much understand, like there's no judgment on my end about that, about feeling heartbroken for them, but very much understanding I'm going to diminish the way I'm feeling.
Oh, totally. I really identified with, like, I mean, you know, even being in, like, being on a table, you know, with your legs in stirrups or your shirt off or, you know, a needle in your breast or a needle in your vagina or wherever.
Yeah.
And just feeling like I'm here, I'm scared, I'm not sure what's happening, but I need this procedure done. And maybe what I feel is wrong, maybe what I feel is normal. Like you're so vulnerable in that particular situation.
And it is, and we'll get to this too a little bit more, but it's so tied to gender. And you really can't dismiss this particular one as tied to gender. There's no way around it. And I've heard this before, but you talk about it in your podcast, how the word hysteria, which is often attached to women's behavior, is actually Greek? Am I remembering the where's
totally.
The origins of that word?
Totally, yeah. So hysteria comes from the Greek, you know, for uterus, right? Like when you hear about a hysterectomy, right? That's uterus. And so the idea is that you know, having an empty uterus was what made women sick and crazy. And the way to fix hysteria was to fill that uterus up, was to get pregnant. And so we see that, right, like resonate symbolically throughout, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, right, where lady, you just need to have a baby, right? All your problems would be solved. You just want to have a baby. That's your problem.
Can we talk about the doctors in the room? So, yes, there were the women that were completely sedated, and obviously their reaction during the procedure would have been different because they were sedated. But the women who were not were telling the doctors that they're in pain. There's one woman who tells you that her bottom was like almost off the table and dangerous because there is a long needle going straight in through their vagina into their body. I mean, it's dangerous, too. How were the doctors and nurses explaining away or dealing with the pain in the moment?
I mean, the answer to that question is so complicated and so layered. So I'll offer a couple of the reasons. So mm-hmm. One reason is that at Yale, they used a drug protocol for doing retrievals, a pain management protocol for retrievals that involved fentanyl and midazolam, which is a sedative. With this drug protocol, patient response varied pretty widely. You know, you could have some patients who were just totally out of it. Some patients awake and chattering, some patients like singing along to the pop songs that were often playing on the radio in the retrieval room. And so there was precedent. There was a precedent for patients experiencing pain that was sometimes severe. So that was one interpretation. I didn't talk to a doctor or a nurse who was like, yeah, I was in, you know, 50 retrievals where women were just screaming out in pain all the time. And I just thought it was normal. You know what I mean? Like if that person exists, that person isn't somebody I spoke to. What was happening was more subtle. There were staffers I spoke to who weren't themselves, you know, involved in painful retrieval after painful retrieval, but they were aware that that there were patient complaints about pain, and you know they developed theories about it. Was it a particular colleague whom you know was perceived to be rough, and then a really poignant reason. Has to do with the doctor or nurse's kind of emotional attunement to the patient, right? So the patient is there. They've spent lots of money to get to this point because these procedures aren't always well covered by insurance. There's a lot of like emotional and physical stress that has led up to this day. And they're there because they want to have a baby. And there is a window of like an hour to, you know, to get the eggs. And that is something that is in the mind of healthcare providers I spoke to from Yale and from elsewhere. You know, that said, right, when a patient is screaming in pain, the appropriate thing would seem to be to stop the procedure and address that pain, right? Like that is kind of the bottom line.
Yeah. So obviously the pain was real. These women were suffering. What was actually happening? What did you discover was the reason why this was happening?
Yeah. So the reason this was happening, there was a nurse at the clinic who was stealing fentanyl and replacing it with saline. So instead of getting fentanyl in their IVs, these patients were getting saline instead. So they weren't getting the fentanyl to manage their pain.
They're literally going in there awake with nothing.
It's complicated to say, like, across the board, mm-hmm. there was nothing, right? Because there were different anesthetic protocols used for different patients. And I don't have, like, everybody's specific medical record to say how much of everything, you know, each person got. But yes, there were patients in there who didn't have an opioid to treat their pain whatsoever.
I mean, really, even one of the women that you spoke to, who was a doctor herself, actually said to them, "You've just given me saline."
Yes.
And it happened twice. She tasted the saline and said, "This isn't fentanyl. I know what fentanyl is like. I give it to patients." So there were some women who understood what was happening to them.
So she was somebody I actually did not talk to. She testified at the nurse's criminal sentencing. And she herself had worked as a trauma surgeon. And yes, she said that she could tell that she wasn't getting fentanyl.
It's just incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, a patient I did speak to, somebody who works as a neuroscientist and an addiction researcher at Yale, when she was going through her own painful retrieval, and, you know, she was just totally surprised at this unexpected pain she felt. And in that moment, she sort of had a fantasy, like, the nurse is stealing the fentanyl. Like, to her, it was sort of like the most obvious explanation, right? Like, fentanyl, it's the most diverted drug in medical settings, and it's a major driver of the opioid crisis. And it just made sort of dreamlike sense to her, right, in this moment, that a nurse must be stealing the fentanyl. Now this wasn't like a theory that was concrete enough that she, you know, wrote letters to the institution or asked them to look into it. But it is something that she sort of like floated by her friends. Like, I can't figure out why this is happening other than a nurse must be stealing the fentanyl. And it was sort of half joking and half, is that what's happening?
And it was. So how did Yale figure it out?
So in October 2020, an anesthesiologist noticed a loose cap on a vial of fentanyl, and that launched an investigation.
How did Yale respond to it? How did the women learn that this had actually been the case?
So they received a letter from Yale. And it was close to Christmas time. They received a letter from Yale, sort of a nondescript, you know, envelope arrives in the mailbox, like it looks like it could be a bill. And then it's a very just sort of like pro forma, like, well, a nurse was stealing fentanyl and replacing it with saline. And, you know, this shouldn't have any effect on your outcomes. And here's a number to call if you want a blood test.
Lines that really struck me was that they discovered there was no harm. What it says is, no reason to believe that this event has had any negative effect on your health or the outcome of the care that you received.
Yeah.
And you went on a bit of a quest to figure out if this was true.
Yeah.
Did you discover anything?
I mean, this idea, right, that there was no effect on the outcomes just made many of the patients livid, right? Because how can this not have a deep, lasting psychological effect? And also, some of them wondered, could it have affected, you know, the eggs that I got? Did I get fewer eggs because I was so in pain that a doctor stopped the procedure early? I mean, that's a legitimate question to ask. But when I looked for, you know, science, there is no study like what happens if we do a procedure on a patient without giving that patient anesthesia. You know, that's not like a study question.
And I guess there's not really, from what I gather from your reporting, too, that there's not really any meaningful studies on women's pain in general.
Yeah. I mean, there was a famous study probably a little over 20 years ago now. It's called The Girl Who Cried Pain. And that sort of launched, you know, a lot more attention to the stuff in this field. But yeah, as far as medicine goes, it's a fairly new thing to be looking at. And I say that with some humility because I'm not a scholar, right, of medical history. But I think it's definitely a true statement, right, that we have much less knowledge of a woman's body than of a man's, just because of the way research has long been done.
So how did finding out that this had happened to them and that there was an explanation for their pain that was obviously not their fault, how did that change the way that the women understood their experience or even felt about their experience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I think for many of them, getting that letter, like there was a sense of relief. Like, I'm not crazy, right? This all makes sense. And then there's anger. You know, how can this happen, right? How can this happen anywhere? How can this happen at Yale? And, you know, and then I think there was a loss of trust for many of them in the medical system, like overall. And I think that loss of trust is not just to do with the fact that the nurse was able to steal fentanyl, but the way that the whole situation was handled.
You know, it's funny, and I'm sure you've heard this before too, but like the comparison between the reaction with Yale, with your story, and like Columbia with the story from Laura Beale about the mm-hmm. doctor who was sexually assaulting patients, the gynecologist. There seems to be that when things like this happen, the public relations and the closing of the ranks to protect the institution sort of ends up being the stronger reaction than the humanity of the people. So I'm wondering your thoughts on that. Like, this is Yale. This is like a very prestigious, important university, medical school, all that stuff. How much of their reaction was about their reputation and the worry about what it would mean and the fallout?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Yale as an institution, like, wouldn't answer any of my questions, except to, you know, to issue a couple different statements. So I can't say for sure exactly what is behind the institutional response. But yes, it certainly seems like the response is about protecting the institution and you know, an awareness of the possibility of a lawsuit.
I'm sure lawyers yeah. were very careful with that letter.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And again, I can't say for sure, you know, did a lawyer look at this letter, but it seems logical that a lawyer would have.
They discovered it was a nurse named Donna. Why was Donna able to steal the drugs? What protocols sort of weren't in place that allowed her to, it seemed pretty easy to me that she was able to do this, that she was able to replace it with saline. Like, that seemed too easy.
Yeah. I mean,
and like, something that you and I could do, if not that we want to, but it just seemed like, oh, you don't even need to understand anything to do this.
Yeah. I mean, there are a bunch of different things to point to. So, for example, at one location of the clinic, the drugs were not stored in what's called a Pyxis machine, which is like a sort of secure vending machine for drugs. And had the fentanyl been stored there, like, would there have been better tracking of it? That said, you know, I definitely talked to plenty of drug diversion specialists. So drug diversion is what it's called when you steal drugs in a medical setting. You know, there are some people who say, well, a Pyxis machine, you know, wouldn't necessarily do anything. What are some other reasons? Donna was, there were times when she was in charge of ordering and inventorying drugs. There was a very strange period when Donna would go out to Walgreens to pick up the fentanyl that was prescribed for the next day's surgery and return to the clinic with it. So that, I hardly even need to say the sentence. Like, there's a chance for abuse there. You know, and then there were some things like Some of the period during which she did this, it was summer 2020. It was COVID, and there weren't. It was like a skeleton crew in that office. There weren't as many people around.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And what do we know about Donna and why she did this?
Sure. So Donna has three children. Donna, at this point, she was in her late 40s. She was divorced from the father of her three children. She didn't respond to any of my requests to speak with her. So what I know about Donna comes from many pages of documents generated by her legal case. She had many family members and friends write character reference letters, and Donna herself wrote a letter to the judge. So it's through these letters primarily that I have a sense of Donna's life and the story she told, as well as conversations, with people who knew her inside the clinic. But she, she said that she was going through a really rough patch with her ex-husband. She didn't feel safe when her children were with him. And she turned to fentanyl to cope. This was not a story that many of the patients found satisfying, believable, whatever word you want to use. But this is the story that Donna offered to the court.
So what was Donna actually charged with?
Donna pleaded guilty to one count of tampering with a consumer product. I can't say if there were other charges against her. I think that must have been the only charge against her, though, this tampering with a consumer product.
Or the one
product.
She agreed to plead guilty to, I suspect. There must have been some negotiation going on there.
Yeah.
I was really struck. I was really struck, and I thought this was such a nice job that you did, that, what started out as a podcast about the women and their experiences, and then the reveal that it was actually a crime that the fentanyl had been switched. And then you really spend some time talking about Donna. And I was just like, wow, so often there's this idea that you have to kind of keep one narrative and one character and, one story. I think this is a good thing, that I can't say for sure who the podcast is about, if it's about Donna, if it's about the women, if it's about more of a sort of grander theory about women's health and pain. And so I just thought that was incredible. But so congrats, because that was very complicated and a lovely way to tell us about a story and for us to always realize that everything is nuanced. And even bad acts have a reason often, and something's behind what they do. And she did plead guilty. So there was just a sentencing hearing. What was, some of the things that you really took from that sentence hearing, that made sentencing her so complicated? Cause it wasn't straightforward from the judge to the victims. It wasn't an easy thing to figure out how to sentence her. So can you talk about a little bit about that?
Sure. So one of the very first legal documents I read connected to the story was the transcript of her sentencing hearing. And that's when I knew that that this was a story. Like, in fact, there was part of me that was like, we could just have actors read this transcript and it would be like an amazing, episode of This American Life or something, because I
100%. Yeah. It was fascinating.
Yeah. It was really gripping. And the judge in the case really wrestled with a lot of the big questions at the heart of this story, questions about addiction and personal responsibility and motherhood and infertility. And so, you know, I think going into that hearing, a lot of the patients, you know, had just sympathy or empathy for Donna's experience of addiction. There was one patient, the woman I mentioned earlier, the neuroscientist and addiction researcher from Yale. You know, she really, she knew that she, based on her work, right, she doesn't believe in incarceration for nonviolent drug crimes. And she wrote a letter to the judge saying, you know, that I had this bad experience, but like, I don't believe that this person should go to prison for it, essentially. And then there were other patients, right, who didn't have necessarily that same conflict. But I think the thing that emerges really strongly in the hearing is that part of Donna's case for a light sentence, she faced between 5 and 6 years, was that she's a mother of these children, and that if she were incarcerated, her ex-husband would most likely get custody. And, you know, and she'd said, right, she didn't feel safe when the children were with him. So was that a good outcome for the children? And some of the patients, including one who was sitting right there in the courtroom that day, a patient named Leah, was like, you know, why does she get to be a mom? It was like Donna's status as a motherhood was somewhat protective. And here are all these patients who long to have a child. And it was just a painful irony.
So what was she sentenced to?
Donna was ultimately sentenced to 4 alternating weekends in prison. And they were timed to coordinate with her custody arrangement. And there were other conditions, too, about substance use treatment. But patients had a lot of complicated feelings about the sentence Donna received.
Including racial, right? You spoke to one patient who was a Black woman who felt that if Donna had been Black, that wouldn't have been the case.
Yeah. I mean, so that patient, Alicia, was, I think her tape about that is so powerful. A number of patients noted this, right? Like, if this had been a Black or brown woman before that judge, would this have been the sentence? I mean, I think you probably don't even have had to, like, look at statistics or demographics or have done research to point to that and say, is, you know, the fact that she's white, like, playing a big role in this sentence. Yeah, so race, motherhood. It was a really complicated hearing.
It's interesting about the motherhood. It absolutely, I agree with what you're saying, too. But I was also on the flip side thinking about the kids,
mm-hmm.
like, that the sentence would really affect them. You know, so often we argue that the justice system doesn't do enough to consider the fallout from crime and punishment. So it's such a complicated thing, right? You know, these things need to happen, but
exactly
when it happens to you, it's a very different feeling.
Exactly. And I think that's what many of the patients felt, right? Like, looked at one way, this was a compassionate sentence. So then they had to struggle with their feelings of victims of this perpetrator.
How did you feel about it? Are you comfortable giving me a bit of your personal opinion about how you felt?
I mean, I made a choice narratively, right, not to be a character in the story. Like, I just sort of didn't need to be. So I think that's whom I'll continue to be in talking about it, which is not to say that I was neutral. I was passionate about this story and about this subject, but I didn't feel like I belonged in it in a first person way.
Why not? I mean, that seems to be the narrative podcast rule number one these days is like, why are you telling the story? So why did you make that choice?
I think partly because of the thing you just said. I think that it's almost a cliche, right? Like, voice and style are very important to me. The idea that the women would be sort of a chorus in the piece came to me very early on. I think like sort of a podcast reporter on a quest persona would have been incompatible with that choral element, which felt so primary to me. And I don't know. I mean, most of the choices I make are like pretty intuitive, and then I go back later and question them. You know, looking back on it, like there were some kind of like logistical things that that I think play into that. So, for example, when I was doing initial interviews with many of the patients, like the Omicron wave had just hit, and the world like wasn't in person. So the interviews were remote. And so, you know, when you're not like in a scene with somebody, there's sort of like less of a reason for you to be like moving through an oral world is one reason. But I think also, you know, then this is so outside of the universe of the retrievals. In recent years, I've done a lot of really personal storytelling about you know, secrets I've kept about my history of eating disorders. And I think I was like ready just not to be out there as an I.
Fair. And speaking of like the how hard it was for you, the restrictions, you had lawyers in the room with you and limited amount of time to talk to these women. I mean, that's intense.
That was intense. So most of the interviews, right, were remote, and we often had cameras off. So the lawyer like wouldn't be in a room with a patient. You know, the lawyer would be in their office or their home office, and the patient would be at her home, and I would be in, you know, usually I was in a booth right next door to this one in the This American Life office. And the lawyers minimally intervened. But, you know, I did have a limited amount of time, and I had to think a lot about how to structure those interviews. I knew that the essential unit of this story was the retrieval, right? There's what did you feel leading up to the retrieval? What did you feel during the retrieval? And then there's the aftermath. So I was able to focus the interviews. But at the same time, like, I knew that this stuff was traumatic and literally painful, right? And so asking people to dredge all that up, I just wanted to be sensitive. And I think one thing that helped is that everybody I was talking to wanted to be talking to me. And you know, I think that's so important when you're talking to somebody about trauma. Like everybody had thought about it and chosen to be there. So that helps a lot.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, the times that you do show up in the interviews where you're talking to them directly and being sympathetic or giving them time came through really well.
Oh, good.
Like your care for these women was very obvious to me, and that was very nice to hear.
Good.
We've talked so much about what happened in the moment, like what happened during the retrieval. But, you know, I was very actually struck, and it's something that just, of course, should have occurred to me that didn't. But the fallout from it was intense for these women.
Yeah.
I mean, they all reacted differently. So can you tell me a few examples of the fallout for these women that sort of lived with them even after they had healed physically from the retrieval?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, a couple things come to mind. So the last episode is episode 5, and that episode opens with one of the pieces of tape that as soon as, you know, it's like as soon as I heard it, I knew that it illustrated something essential. There was a patient named Isha, and, you know, she got pregnant, she had a baby, and she went to like her 6 weeks postpartum checkup, and it came up that Isha was involved in this lawsuit against Yale. And the doctor kind of looked at her and was like, well, what's the big deal? You got pregnant. And that message that the only thing that matters is like this healthy baby, that the only thing that matters is that particular outcome, and that nothing that came before this matters, you know, just was infuriating. And, you know, this pain, right, it was acute pain in a moment, but it reverberates later on. you know, it's sort of shrouding the way that the women who had children, that these children came into the world. Maybe not exactly that across the board for all of them, but many of them got pregnant. And so then they're in the medical system, right? They're going to like a million appointments. And so there's a lot of anxiety and mistrust to navigate during that process. You know, and then there's a patient named Leia who said something that that I find really interesting too. She sort of talked about how the onus is on the patients to talk about this thing if they want anything to change. You know, they need to tell their stories for this lawsuit. They were telling their stories to me to draw attention to maybe not only the specific thing at Yale, but sort of the underlying issue of women not being listened to, women being ignored, women being dismissed in medical settings. But the onus was on them to tell their stories. And that takes a toll, too.
How did you start to think about the whole pressure on women to have babies? I don't want to take away from the fact that these women did want to have babies and that they should do whatever they need to do to get there. But did you come across that in your own internal conversations about this constant pressure on women, that being a mother is what we have to do at a certain point in our lives?
I mean, I didn't sort of interrogate it for myself in that big picture way in the work on the podcast. I mean, the thing I was looking hard at was, IVF can be an arduous process, even if like the nurse isn't stealing the fentanyl, right?
Yeah.
So I was thinking about that, and there was a really wonderful study I came across about reasons, right, people leave IVF or stay with IVF, and I thought about, you know, I guess I am coming in a first person way, but so I have two children. I didn't go through IVF, but I really wanted children, and I could imagine myself right into that position of being like, well, this is the way that's available to me. I really want this. Like, I'll go through it. So I think there are a million right lessons one could take away from the podcast, but I think it's essential to look at ways to make fertility treatment, kinder and gentler and more humane, you know, whatever that involves. And that's a whole other subject. That's huge.
So the criminal case is obviously done, but there's a civil case continuing. Is that correct?
Yes.
Tell me more about that and who's involved.
So there are around 80 plaintiffs, and those are women and their partners. The case is a long way off from trial. If it goes to trial, right, there's always the possibility it could be settled. But I think right now it's like jury selection is likely January 2025, I think, is the date that I saw the last time I checked.
And how much of an impact did your podcast have? Like, did Yale make any changes? Did anybody, I know you didn't really get a lot from Yale while you were doing the reporting, but what has come from the podcast?
I mean, I think at Yale specifically, you know, individuals at Yale reached out to me to tell me how they were using the podcast. You know, I got an email from somebody who said she was going to teach it in an ethics course to med students. I heard from another person who had taught it in a history of science and medicine program. I don't know about like specific changes at the fertility clinic or anything like that. You know, I just got back this weekend from speaking at a medical conference that included a number of OBGYNs and others, and I'm going to be speaking at some other medical conferences in the months ahead, and that to me is really exciting, right? That that healthcare providers listened and are interested and want to continue this conversation, because you know, one of my disappointments in the podcast is I wish I could have told the stories of the healthcare providers with the same nuance and complexity as I told the patient's stories, because, you know, all of these problems, they're easier to understand, to get a handle on, to solve if we have the whole picture.
And why they wouldn't talk to you, just because they weren't allowed? Yale said no.
They told me they, you know, feared retaliation or legal exposure. And those seemed to be very real fears for them. And I appreciated the ones who took the risk of speaking to me, even off the record.
Where's Donna now? How is she doing? Do you have any idea?
I don't know. I don't know. You know, I really wanted to talk to Donna. I really wanted to hear her story. You know, when I came across this story, I initially thought it was going to be about addiction, that it was going to be on the collision of Donna's need for fentanyl with the patient's need to have a child. And sometimes I wondered if, you know, if after the podcast, you know, I would hear from her or someone in her family. I am very, you know, curious about her experience and how she reflects on it now. I mean, that was another thing, though. When I did think about, like, well, what if I do talk to Donna? What would that be like? You know, she was so close to this experience. I wonder how reflective she would have been able to be.
Yeah. Well, Susan, thank you. This has been such a great conversation, and I appreciate the time you gave us.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you for your interest. Yeah, I was really pleased to talk with you.
You've been listening to Crime Story from CBC Podcasts. We drop a new episode every Monday. You can get our next episode a week early on CBC Podcasts' YouTube channel or by subscribing to the CBC Podcasts True Crime channel on Apple Podcasts. In addition to early access, subscribers to our True Crime channel also listen ad-free. Crime Story is written and hosted by me. Our producers are Alexis Green and Sarah Clayton. Sound design by Graham McDonald. Our senior producer is Jeff Turner. Our video producer is Evan Agard. Our YouTube producer is John Lee. Executive producers are Cecil Fernandez and Chris Oak. Tanya Springer is CBC Podcast Senior Manager, and Arif Narani is the Director of CBC Podcasts.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.